What's going on, Acid Horizon fans? Did you know that this coming fall, we have a few live events on the way? One of our first live events will be in September in State College, Pennsylvania, and it will feature Tariq Goddard of Repeater Books, where he will talk about his most recent book, High John the Conqueror, a novel. And going forward, we will have a book launch event for Anti-Oculus, A Philosophy of Escape, in London on November 18th at Hausmann's Books. And it looks like we may have one in New York City, and the details about that are forthcoming. The best way to stay current with all of the info is to follow us on Twitter or Instagram or subscribe to our Patreon. You can navigate to the show links below while you're listening. Today, Eden from Death Sentence returns to talk to us about the solar punk aesthetic in science fiction and the way that the science fiction genre tends to import certain political beliefs and values. All right, let's get to the show.
Welcome to Acid Horizon, the Fury podcast. And today we welcome back Eden of Heavy Blog is Heavy and of the Mighty Death Sentence podcast to talk about all things science fictional and the class struggle for the future of the imagination. So Eden has one of his recent papers called The Men Who Sold the Moon on solar punk and its misuses and the ways in which some of our faves in the golden age of science fiction might have been a bit lib. Anyway, Eden, welcome back.
Thank you. Your introductions are always the best. I really like the introductions. Thank you for having me back. It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. I mean, so let's just open up with, I guess, what your paper's responding to is that you see this as a kind of a recuperation of science fiction, or rather there's a dominant or hegemonic form of science fiction. You say that it always, you know, tells us tame stories to create very boring, very repetitive, and very safe futures. You know, like even Star Trek's idea of the replicators is ultimately one which essentially goes, okay, this technology will solve everything. And you don't have a class struggle to get there. You might have some slight eugenics wars, and that's how you get Khan, but even Khan is played by Benedict Cumberbatch in the new one in some sort of weird 9/11 allegory. So who knows?
Yeah, I think I don't remember exactly when I read Extra Statecraft, The Power of Infrastructure Space by Keller Easterling. That was, I think, in 2020 or 2019, but it really changed my life. Like, I really recommend reading the book. It's kind of like a disclaimer, maybe, it's a really hard to read book. You know, she's very much of the tradition of like McLuhan and Jameson and so on. So the writing can be a bit dense at times. But she explores this really interesting idea of infrastructure and mostly how infrastructure is replicating code. So think about the example I like to always give when I talk about this. You know, that the show Weeds that aired in the US like a decade ago, it had this opening with the suburbia, I think it was Los Angeles or somewhere in California, where all the houses are the same. And the idea is not just that the houses are the same, it's that the next house is also the same because it's a replicating code, right? That's infrastructure. A road is meant to be built many times over. You don't build one road, right? You replicate it across the space. So Easterling, in her book, she explores how stuff like mobile networks, how that's an infrastructure that replicates itself, trade zones, and so on. Why am I talking about this? Because I started following the book, I started thinking about cultural infrastructure, right? And how culture replicates ideas inside of it. So for example, when you start to write a science fiction story, you don't actually write it from scratch, right? You're relying on infrastructure, tropes, metaphors, structures of books, and you replicate them, right? You don't reinvent the book every time you write a book. You're tapping into literary infrastructure and you replicate it. The problem is, of course, is that infrastructure is kind of like a carrier wave for ideology, class politics, economical structures, and so on. And when you replicate the structure, you inadvertently or advertently by purpose, you replicate all those structures, right? So if I'm just writing a science fiction book, and I import all of the main tropes as my infrastructure. With them, I import all of the politics that those tropes carry. So for example, if I just want a protagonist and I just copy paste like a science fiction protagonist, that protagonist is probably male, white, sort of like an adventurer, entrepreneur kind of trope, Right? And if you look at science fiction, that's exactly what happens. You try to write something that is weird and new and explores new ideas, but the more of those tropes you copy-paste, the more of the politics you import with them. And when you look at a lot of science fiction, that's what it does. It's supposedly fresh and innovative, but it replicates a lot of those ideas. Star Trek, which you already mentioned, is a fantastic idea. Yes, it's a lot of, even the original series, but also as you move it through time, a lot of Star Trek can be radical, right? Deep Space Nine looks at like a very thin allegory to Palestinian and Zionist struggle and says some interesting things. But there are also almost, in Star Trek in general, almost zero non-cis, non-hetero romantic relationships. And when there are, they're this weird outlier, right? So by just importing a lot of these tropes, suddenly, you know, hegemonic ideas of sexual relationships are important as well. Again, inadvertently or sometimes on purpose. So that's an example of how something that is supposedly cutting edge and in the far future and experimental and does all these social commentaries, in the underlying infrastructure of the story that it imports, it contains a lot of conservatism, a lot of mainstream hegemonic ideas.
And you do highlight as well some sort of counter figures to this, or maybe sort of non-hegemonic, maybe not necessarily counter-hegemonic writers. I mean, Octavia Butler, Ursula K. Le Guin, and of course for me, the one who stands out the most is really the new wave of science fiction that comes around with people like that, and of course people like Samuel R. Delaney as well, who sort of really changes the very temporal fabric of science fiction. So would you say it's really a problem of the Golden Age and its legacy, but only insofar as it has this legacy because it appeals to a certain kind of very American sensibility? I mean, thinking about Malcolm Harris's recent book on Palo Alto and the Californian ideology, as it's put it, you do talk quite a bit about this, especially regarding writers like Asimov. I was wondering if we could unpack this techno-positivity that you see as sort of problematic.
So let's actually start from the opposite end of the temporal line and talk about like the state of science fiction today. So you're right that there is a lot of new wave and what's today called the new weird. So Jeff Vandermeer, Elvia Wilk, people of that sort, writing science fiction, and it's really interesting. But if you look at the majority of the science fiction that's done today, the same kind of importing of infrastructure happens, just from a different perspective. There was a change in science fiction in 2014 and 15. I don't know if we want to go into the whole phases of what happened, but there was like a alt-right in science fiction. It was called the Sad Puppies, right? That's literally what they were called. don't ask me why. They tried to take over the Hugo Awards by creating like a voting block that would only vote for, as they like to call it, non-woke literature, right? And they failed completely. Like all of the alt-right, right? They completely failed in what they were trying to do, but they created a backlash of, for lack of a better word, woke science fiction. And there too, the infrastructure is imported without even thinking about it. So a good exercise that I like people to do when I talk about these things is go to Tor.com, arguably the biggest publisher of science fiction today, and just read the blurbs for the books and see how much they sound alike. They'll all start with like, they won't say anything about the story. They'll start by saying, this book features predominantly queer characters. This book features predominantly indigenous or people of color characters. Like they start from the identity of the characters in the book, right? So their infrastructure is identity politics, right? Identity politics, because of that backlash to the conservative movement in science fiction, has become the infrastructure for how these stories are told. So instead of focusing on plot points, now what's important is the identity of the protagonists being discussed. All of which to say, my point is not necessarily these politics bad, these politics are good, but we need to examine the mechanisms which import politics into science fiction without, I don't know if you want to use the word subconsciously or inadvertently or invisibly. Right? Because that's how power likes to operate. When power has to reveal itself, it means that power has failed. As the more power is successful, the more invisible it is. It becomes invisible for being obvious, natural. And that's, so it's not about whether it's conservative or not. It's about the fact that the power mechanisms that operate inside of science fiction, for the most part, are invisible. They're not interrogated. They're taken for granted.
There's one word I just want to just pull on that thread a little bit, which is the word import in relation to politics. Do you think it's, do you mean in a sense of it literally is certain elements of literally translating certain political presuppositions, or is it more like a kind of capture within the limits of basically the editorial decisions of certain publishing boards? Because I don't think you're saying at all that, you know, it's not political when political politics arrives in it, but rather there's a delimiting in advance, a control system, a preempting of the possibility of science fiction within those certain brackets.
Yeah. So when I say import, and that's actually a really good question, like you're interrogating me on the fly. It's not something that I actually thought of, but if I want to address it, there's the lie of the aesthetic experience separate from the political experience. And that's a complete lie, right? It's impossible. There's no unmediated aesthetic experience. But the aesthetic experience here is being used to convey, again, I'm using a word with like motion, right? To convey a political message. And if you think about conveyor belts, I like the word convey here. There's one conveyor belt, which is the aesthetic conveyor belt. That's giving you aesthetic experience. And that is being interrogated and discussed. Is my word usage good? How good is my grammar? How interesting is my dialogue? And so on. But then there's a conveyor belt underneath it, which is conveying political ideas to you. And that conveyor belt is hardly interrogated in mainstream science fiction. What is my politics? What am I saying here? What am I supposing? What am I leaving out? Instead of interrogating that, all these tropes and templates and obvious ideas are used. There aren't many Tor.com books that ask, why are we doing identity politics? What do we lose when we do identity politics? What do we gain when we do identity politics? Who is left out? And so on and so forth, right? It's taken as for granted, and it kind of rides along with the aesthetic experience and is imported along, again, to go back to that word, with the aesthetic experience. Without the subject, us, the reader, necessarily being aware of it and being cognizant of it and the worldview which it wants to create in us.
Yeah, Eden, thanks for coming back on the show. It's good to see you again. I'm really glad that you brought this topic to the fore, and I wish I had had this essay a few months back when there was a meme circulating online that perhaps at least all of us here are probably familiar with, and maybe the listeners as well. And unfortunately, the name of the anime escapes me, but there was a small clip of like it looked like Studio Ghibli, like a, you know, Hayao Miyazaki kind of anime. And basically the scene was this sort of idyllic vignette, you know, with trees sprouting all kinds of fruit and all sorts of minimalist technology being incorporated into the garden. And it was this, it sort of culminated in this leisure scene where like a family or a commune kind of sat upon the precipice and looked down upon the distant city. And this was held up as the image of solar punk, right?
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, this is from the aesthetic standpoint, this is a very attractive image. And I quote tweeted it or whatever. And I had sort of mixed responses on it because I think on the one hand, what it does is that image taps part of our imagination, which does have a positive dimension to it. But using what you're saying about importing politics, it raises the question of whether or not certain political presuppositions are being mystified or obfuscated in that image. And I wish at the time I was less, I wish I was like less playful about it and maybe a little bit more serious about it. And then of course you don't want to get into the online discourse because then you lose half a day of your life defending yourself. But I think the framework that you're presenting here helps us understand that because when I watch science fiction films, I think that was, you know, I didn't have a sort of rhetorical sense of that question, but you would often wonder what the transformation of society as we know it now to whatever we're seeing now looks like. What was the element of refusal like at the beginning? Where did people say, this is not how we're going to live anymore? Or where was the element of affirmation? And what were the obstacles that had to have been overcome? And perhaps how is that residue manifest in the narrative of that world? To me, that would be the definition of a rich science fiction tale. And it makes me wonder, is there any specific story or narrative or series that does do that? And so maybe you can answer those questions.
Yeah. So I actually close out my essay by analyzing that ad that you mentioned, and it's for Chobani, an American yogurt company. And Chobani is a really good example because they want to be a woke corporation, right? And they actually did really real concessions for their workers. They were put on blast for using immigrants in their labor, and their response was to give a bunch of their veteran workers shares in the company. So they're trying to thread that needle of like a modern corporation. Of course, the concessions are nonsense. That's why we call them concessions, right? They do it so there won't be a revolution, I mean, down the line. And they use that ad as well to paint this like very positive image of themselves. By the way, the other example that I analyze is much less benign, and that is Saudi Arabia's NEOM project. Saudi Arabia is building this huge project. Well, might be building. It's probably just a money laundering scheme. But they have a whole website for it, if listeners are unaware. They purport to be building The Line, which is a huge city in the middle of the desert, alongside an industrial complex, a research complex, and so on. And all of the commercial language around it is solarpunk, right? Like you see people swimming in rivers in the city and taking zero emission transportation everywhere, and there's bountiful growth and so on. So when I saw that ad for the first time, the question that I asked was also a question of infrastructure. Okay, where are all these robots built? And once they're built, how do they get shipped to the farm? Because when you look at the city, there's no airport, there's no train station, there are no warehouses. Everything looks residential or corporate or offices and so on. There's no infrastructure, right? Because it doesn't want to ask the question of infrastructure. Because the answer is, let's say we had this technology today, it would be built in awful conditions by workers being exploited for their labor, probably not in the West, right? In awful conditions. And the people who are eating all this fresh produce being made by these robots don't want to think about the factory worker that has to be immiserated for their food. Now, of course, science fiction is always about the present, right? It's the same with Chobani. You want to eat your woke yogurt without thinking about the conditions in which the yogurt was produced or the plastic that the packaging is made of and so on. This, of course, all goes back. We already said Ursula Le Guin, right? I think I made the joke last time I was here that I have to mention her on every podcast episode I'm on, or I get my license revoked. This is Those Who Walk Away from Omelas, right? Her famous short story where a utopia is predicated on the suffering of one child in a basement. Right? And Omelas is perfect, like picture perfect. The only problem is that this kid has to suffer, to be beaten. And there are those who walk away from that utopia. Now, of course, what Le Guin is trying to say is we're in a much worse situation. Right? There's not one child in a basement. There's hundreds of thousands of children in basements and millions and tens of millions of people suffering. Right? And that's exactly what she tries to do in that short story, is interrogate that infrastructure. Now, to go to the positive direction and like talk about stories that maybe do a better job at this, there are a few like more recent examples. First, there's Le Guin's Dispossessed, right? That's the classic like political science fiction, also has elements of solarpunk because of the desert planet and how they're trying to like terraform it and so on, or not terraform it, adapt to its house conditions. But that book was released like 40 years ago. So I don't like it when people just give that as an example because it, you know, it's good, but there's also been some stuff since then. So Kim Stanley Robinson, which usually I don't really like, he wrote a series of books called The Free Californians, which looks at, he likes to do those time lapses, right? To jump into the future a few times. So it looks at California right after the apocalypse, when they've already resettled, and then as a utopia that was built on those foundations, which is really interesting. And then you also have Becky Chambers. Becky Chambers is a fantastic author who works in sci-fi, but also wrote the Monk and Robot series, which is a solarpunk utopia society where actually robots and technology and automation have been rejected because the robots asked for emancipation. And it kind of explores how to do automation, how to do Utopia with people instead of with automation and with hidden labor and stuff like that. So those are the books. There are many more, not many, there are a few more, but those are like the counterexamples that I could give. What makes them good? Again, going back to my previous point, they interrogate their political assumptions. Right. So, okay, for Becky Chambers, for example, if I want to build a society where people can change careers on a whim, that's kind of like one of the foundations of the society that she imagines. What is lost? Right? What is lost when specialization disappears? How do the people who insist on being specialists, how are they perceived? How do they suffer for being specialists? How do human interactions change when we hop careers, when we're not defined by our work anymore? Instead of just saying, trust me, bro, right? Like, here's a Gedanken experiment. What if we didn't have said jobs? Whoa, let's do a cool storyline in there. No, she spends time like asking those social and political questions and diving a bit deeper into it, which is, to maybe summarize this answer of mine, the problem with solopunk. Solopunk, I have never seen, by the way, an aesthetic or a genre be co-opted by corporations faster than solopunk. Right? Solopunk has been around for what? 6-7 years? Maybe, and already Chobani and the goddamn Saudi and Arabian government, right, like, are co-opting it. It was so fast because the genre is pure aesthetics or wants to be. It's not, right, because we just said there's no such thing. It wants to be pure aesthetics. And because it doesn't interrogate its politics, it leaves it open for any player to inject their own politics and play it for their own agenda. And it's happening. Like, these are just two examples. It's all over the place. So maybe that answers the question, like, what is missing from solopunk that allows these corporations and these states to take advantage of it and use it to push their agendas?
Yeah, it seems to me that solarpunk is kind of like the TED Talk aesthetic of the science fiction genre. But it looks like Will has a question. Go for it, Will.
Yeah, I'm not so sure solarpunk is something that's co-opted as much as it is all of the assumptions about the technology of governance as such.
Yeah.
Like, solarpunk just is biopolitics aestheticized. Like, it's not, like, I don't, like, to treat solarpunk, I think there's a mistake in treating solar, and of course, like, there are things like Those Who Walk Away or Dispossessed, who try to articulate an account of maybe the exception that is sort of the rule of these kinds of forms of utopian thought, right? But in a certain sense, like Erewhon, right? Samuel Butler is a pretty close to soul. I don't think these things, like, one of the issues with like literary categorization is like I don't actually think like solarpunk is only 6 or 7 years old, right? Like we've seen USSR propaganda that we would probably, were we to say like this is the cover of an upcoming book, we would say, oh, this is very solarpunk. Like, yeah. the promise of the pristine orchestrated metropolis, like Metropolis is solarpunk. Like Fritz Lang's Metropolis participates in solarpunk. I don't think this is something that can be co-opted because it accepts the predications of statecraft that we understand as the statistical articulation of society as the optimization of human life processes, right? Yeah. Like,
I agree 100%. I think the word co-opted is not right here. And I was actually going to go to this direction from what Craig said about TED Talk. Solopunk is the TED Talk of science fiction. Science fiction is the TED Talk of science fiction. That's the point in my article. Science fiction, more science fiction is totally fine with statecraft as such, like Will said, than science fiction that isn't. Right? Like, science fiction is mainstream. Science fiction is the hegemony. That's the point I was trying to make in my article. It's not that science fiction is being subverted. The subversion would be us trying to make it radical. Right? Its default mode is to serve biopolitics, is to serve statecraft, is to serve the capitalist mode of production. And that's why I use the Golden Age, right, as an inception point. Of course, you could say that science fiction existed way before the Golden Age, and you'd be right, but that's kind of like the birth of the idea of the genre as a category. All those people, and this is what I say in the article, like going after the bad guys of science fiction, like Robert Heinlein or John Campbell or Jack Vance, all these overtly conservative people, is easy. The hard part is that the good guys only go as far as liberalism, right? Like the left wing of science fiction is centrist. It's not leftist, right? Like Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov is often given as a counterpoint to Robert Heinlein, right? These are names that arrive together with the reason is obvious, right? They're the titans of their era. And Asimov is given as a political counterpoint to Heinlein. And in some ways, that's true, right? Like Heinlein was a misogynist. He was an objectivist. He was a war hawk. Whereas Asimov is more of a rationalist, right? He was a feminist back in the 50s when it was not as in vogue as it is today. And he believed in, politics beyond realpolitik. And he was a humanist. But that's all he was. Right? Think about Foundation. Foundation, where a mathematician solves history, right? A mathematician solves politics. That is the American technician, statecraft for technicians par excellence. It's the technocracy written large, and he doesn't apologize for it. It's not that just give me this thing so I can tell a cool story. It's like, no, this is good. Like, if politicians capitulated to mathematicians, we would have a better society, right? And then 40 years later or 50 years later, you get actual people, actual scientists, who was signed to Rationalia. It was a petition by a few science communicators to create a rational state. Neil deGrasse Tyson, of course, Richard Dawkins, of course, all these people signed a petition. I think it was 9 or 10 of these voices, Bill Nye and people like that, to found a state run by rational technocracy. So these ideas are, I agree with you, Will, 100%. Like this genre serves the obvious state of being, the normalcy of statecraft.
Can I just want to follow up then, because there are ways in which, because we recently, or a few months ago, maybe now, did an episode on Ellison's, the short story, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream.
Scream, yeah.
Right. Where in a sense, there's a politics there. I mean, obviously, it's a political text about the Cold War, but the politics is the technology, right? It takes understanding that the political content of that text is the ontology of technology that it carries. I'm wondering if, in a certain sense, that's what seems to be missing, is this demand to produce an account of technology and then beside it a politics, rather than understanding that politics is a techne, right? And that technology is not pre-political, or as Deleuze would say, the machine is social before it is concrete and technical, right? Yeah. That's his account of Foucault, and his account of Virilio is that these two theorists show that these machines are preceded by political forces before they become the prison, before they become the highway, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree 100% that is the demand. The demand is to expose politics, or to discuss politics as a technology, and technology as political, pre-political, as you said. And there are two examples that I like to give in this context, again, both from Star Trek. One is the replicator, which we already mentioned, and the other one is teleportation. So starting with replicators, the idea that you first have a replicator and that solves hunger is absurd. Right? First there is the technology, and then it revolutionizes the social order. To create a replicator, you first need a society that cares about hunger. Right? Without a society that cares about the hunger of its every single individual, there's no reason for a replicator to exist. The political structure comes before the technology. But in Star Trek, the political origins of the replicator are completely obfuscated. They don't exist in a community that is graphomaniac, that cannot stop writing lore. There is no political lore for the replicator. There's political lore for almost anything else in the Star Trek universe, but no one, to my knowledge, maybe it's out there and I haven't seen it, but it's definitely not popular. There's no accounting for what kind of society existed that even made the replicator a priority in the first place, right? So that's an example of how the technology comes first as this pure scientific endeavor, And then it creates a politics where we know that's not the way it works. And then teleportation, I think, is even more interesting because there's this a metaphysical problem of like, is the person who exits the replicate, the teleporter, is it the same person? Right. So it's kind of like a take on Hume, right? Like, is your identity maintained for your physical existence and so on? And forget the metaphysical question because I don't think it's that interesting and there's no answer as like many of these metaphysical questions. But no one asks that question in Star Trek, right? Like, I want an episode of Star Trek where someone is afraid to go into the replicate, into the teleporter, sorry, because they say it's murder. Right? Like, you're murdering me and reconstituting me somewhere else, by the way, so that I can get the mission done. Right? Like, you're murdering me on the ship, so me on the planet can do the mission, and then you're murdering the me on the planet so I can come back to the ship so I can do the next mission. And they just don't talk about it. The closest that they get to is in Voyager. There's a really good episode, by the way. Everybody who likes biopolitics and Foucault and stuff like that should watch it. Well, a teleporter merges two individuals. Tuvok and Neelix are merged into Tuvix. And the episode ends with them separating them again and murdering Tuvix. Right? So that's a super interesting episode and discusses like the right to life and state murder and stuff like that. But that's the closest it comes, and it doesn't do a very good job. Like, don't expect, you know, a subtle discussion of these points, but at least it recognizes that they exist. So, but Star Trek, of course, here, just to wrap this up, Adam, the Star Trek here is a stand-in, right, for the rest of mainstream science fiction that doesn't come close to that revelation, like you said, of technological is always pre-political. The machine is social before it is concrete. That's the main supposition. First the machine, then the society that arises from the machine.
And any Trekkies listening right now, I need to remind you that Reg Barclay was not afraid of the teleporter based on any metaphysical assumption of his. They just presented him as just being a weird little guy. That was pathologized. It wasn't metaphysical. But yeah. I mean, I love this idea. I think it's so true, the idea that the machine comes first. I mean, this is kind of the most, not necessarily annoying, but maybe disappointing thing. And when you get into books like Ian M. Banks' The Culture Series, because they just have these minds have solved everything and everything is solved. And it's actually about how they navigate that, which is still more political than it could be, which is still, you know, whether you praise to that extent. But yeah, I mean, taking it back to the golden age here, I mean, this is the age of what they called, you know, the triple revolutions. So in 1964, this memo went to LBJ. Harold Ellison references it at one point. There are three revolutions were now considered to be in fact in the United States. Weaponry from the bomb, cyber nation from the cybernetics movement, and human rights. And they thought these three were more or less intertwined. And I think that the specter here of cybernetics and sort of the impulse of that movement as a revolution really haunts, I think, a lot of our discussions today. Because I think, especially with someone like Asimov, I remember recently watching it on YouTube, actually. Listeners, there's a documentary called The Futurists on YouTube. It has Asimov, it has Bucky Fuller, other people like that, and it's essentially a bunch of men in like this very like Mad Men style suit fiction saying what the future is going to be like, what we're going to have to do. And the idea was that the technology of cybernetics was essentially already kicking in, and therefore it's only a matter of time. And you can see in solarpunk this revival of the images of some of the poetry of that era, you know, all watched over by machines of love and grace. They talk about, you know, these cybernetic meadows, and it almost seems like for solarpunk, coming after cyberpunk, it's trying to offer us that maybe we could still have, I mean, we're not going to go to Mars, but we can still have the same things that we can have the treats that it promised us. We just need to do a nice cleaner cybernetics. You know, remember the cybernetic meadow before everything started going a little bit too Terminator, before, you know, LA started looking like Blade Runner. And it does seem like it is a sense of having one's yogurt and then eating it, because, I mean, the material presuppositions of milk. Whilst I do enjoy the occasional steak, I know what I know how the sausage is made. Let's be honest here. And like the material presuppositions, the ideological presuppositions, frame it around something like yogurt is quite central there. And so this absolute techno-positivism feeds into it.
Yeah. So it's really good that you brought up cybernetics, because this allows me to plug one of my favorite people and writers on science fiction in a field, and that is Gareth Damian Martin, also known as Jump Over the Edge. I don't know, I'm seeing contradictory stuff. They are a game developer. They made Citizen Sleeper, which is a very good game if you want to interrogate science fiction and stuff like that. And before they made Citizen Sleeper, they also had a very interesting blog. Now I can't find it because when I Google them, all I get is Citizen Sleeper. But, you know, whatever, small price to pay. And they had this really interesting article about remembering the origins of cybernetics and where cybernetics actually started. And it started as, damn, now the name of the psychotherapist escapes me. He was this super unethical psychotherapist, worked in the 50s and did all these experiments. I'll find him in a second. And it was basically, how could we learn from disabled individuals? How could we use their way of living to learn about how we might adapt to outer space? Okay, so think about an abled person walking into a spaceship, zero gravity environment for the first time. And then think about someone who on Earth is disabled. Let's say they're in a wheelchair, right? They've lost the capacity to walk, and they arrive to that zero gravity environment. The disabled person, so the research supposition goes, would be better at adapting to zero gravity than the abled person, because this would not be their first experience of disablement, right? They would have resiliency that emerges from their disablement. So what if we could use a field, right, to augment the human body and the human psyche and prepare it in advance for all of these situations, like space exploration, right? Learning from disabled individuals. That is one of the original genesis of the idea of cybernetics, right? Of guiding the body, guiding the human psyche to adapt to these extreme situations. Fast forward to 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I think, Becky Chambers wrote To Be Taught a Fortunate, science fiction book about astronauts that when they discover new environments, they use patches, if I remember correctly, to modify their genetics, which then gives them the correct abnormalities to adapt to the environment, right? So let's say you find a planet that is very hot, you would splice or edit your genes and suddenly give yourself scaly skin that allows you to survive these environments. But that's a simple example, because they also do things to their psyche, right? They, for example, they make themselves obsessive about loneliness so that loneliness becomes something to look forward to rather than something to dread. And she interrogates this idea of like messing around with the human body and taking things that would otherwise feel like disablements and repositioning them in the extremities of space and looking at them as positives or methods of adaptation, right? So that's an example of how science fiction can be radical. It can ask interesting questions about, for example, how we use our bodies, or how we think about the category of disablement and enabled, right? How disadvantages can become advantages. And how, most importantly, I think for Chambers, space as an extreme frontier can be used to challenge our suppositions that we carry with us on Earth. And sorry to add on a negative note, I can't help myself because most of it is negative. That's another example of assumptions that most of science fiction just doesn't bother with. Oh, we're in space? Yeah, a few things will be different. Well, if we're real for a second, I mean, it's funny to use that term here, but go with me. If we do go to space as a humanity, we will be in 50, 100 years, we should be unrecognizable to people who stayed on Earth. Unrecognizable socially, politically, economically, biologically. Like the only way we go there and we stay the same is if we let capitalists take us there, because they'll do whatever they can to keep things as they are on Earth. They're already doing it, of course. They already want to maintain self-lord relationships. They already want to maintain debt. They're already working on all this stuff. But if we actually go to space and if we actually embrace the potential of it, it would change us radically. But most of science fiction is like, yeah, we'll go fast and we'll have lasers. No, tell me things about like parenthood. Tell me things about sex. Tell me things about food. Like, show me how these categories are radically challenged by these new situations instead of just, like we said, copy-pasting how we do things here, but now there are fast ships and they're cool and they shoot lasers and whatever.
It seems the difficulty that science fiction has is escaping the sort of rationality that's inherent within the system of political domination within which we live, to the extent that it almost seems as if the medium is the message in some ways. And even in those cases where science fiction attempts to, you know, tap into queer struggles, the struggles of peoples of color, and even the class struggle, I'm thinking recently with, well, it was a few months ago now, where the folks who work on Andor, the Star Wars series, went on strike. This series is held up as being sensitive to worker issues, or at least brushes up against them. I don't know. I'm only really following Jason Reed's comments about it online. The genre itself, coupled with the very mode of distribution, whether that's through the sort of massive global Barnes and Noble apparatus that puts out whatever popular science fiction is popular that year, or whatever we see on Netflix, for example, seems to perhaps preempt a deep interrogation of these presuppositions. And I mean, I think that's basically the whole arc of our discussion here, but I'd like to point specifically to the idea that perhaps science fiction, well, the medium is the message in some ways. And do you see an antidote to remedying that? Like even with the whole thing about using disability and trying to convert that into some sort of extreme adaptation, it doesn't seem to me that there's putting a spin on it that doesn't re-inject it with the rationality presupposed in the disciplinary society and the control society.
So, I mean, it's a huge challenge. And there's a reason I'm not an author, right? Like I'm not, I write some stuff here and there, like short stories, but it's a big challenge. But I do think that there are science fiction stories being written that are truly radical. I'd like, they truly ask us to do things that are radical. For example, Jeff Vandermeer's Dead Astronauts. Jeff Vandermeer's Dead Astronauts, spoilers for one of the weirdest books you'll read. So I'm not sure how much spoilers even matter. The last chapter is written from the perspective of a fox. Of a fox railing against human society and human greed and trying to channel, like, it can't, of course, be written from the perspective of a fox, right? Because Jeff Vandermeer is not a fox. But it's not like a human being as a fox. It tries to go further. It tries to become the animal, become the creature. It tries to have empathy for non-human subjects. You could say that it fails. It has to fail, right? Because it uses human language. But the act itself is not something you know, it's not run of the mill. It challenges like the medium itself, as you said. So that's one example. And Vandermeer does this in other places as well. This is just one of my favorites, and it truly goes radical. There's also like a chapter written from the perspective of like a Leviathan, like a whale, that is even weirder. It comes in fragments and these like deep worlds that are unintelligible to humans. Like the chapter makes no sense, right? And that's how you know. Another good example, Peter Watts. Peter Watts wrote Blindsight. That's like famous book. Ex-marine biologist, by the way, so maybe there's like an interesting connection there. He writes a lot about his main character, for example, suffers from multiple personality disorder and was selected for the mission in space because of it. And it's not recuperated. It's not, and therefore you're a good astronaut, good job, we salute you. But he interrogates like how difficult that is and how it changes their perspective on things. And the aliens they encounter are truly alien. It's like this fungal-based life form, and he tries to write from its perspective as well. Elvia Wilk is another example I can give here. She wrote Oval, which is a really interesting novel about Berlin, and it's kind of like creative class that's in bed with tech companies, but has a storyline about the boyfriend of the protagonist develops a pill that makes people altruistic, like makes them overly altruistic. And then she interrogates what that does to society. So I agree with you that it's very, very hard to write any book that challenges the rational basis of society, because by the act of writing a book, you're putting words into order and you're using all of these mechanisms. But if you push against the limits of intelligibility and you try to use prose and poetry to communicate like radical situations in which the formula is inherently different. And when I say the formula, I mean our day-to-day lives, our day-to-day suppositions, which enable those lives, are inherently different. You start to get somewhere, maybe close to a radical science fiction. And if you want like an aesthetic litmus test, maybe, which is something that I've discovered over the last years doing Death Sentence, if it's really weird, you should be bewildered at some point. Like you should be confused. You read a chapter, maybe it's only one chapter, maybe it's the entire book. But as you're reading it, you're like, what is happening? Like, I literally don't have the tools to put this into legible order. Because obviously, if it's unintelligible, then you transgressed, right? You went beyond some of these tools that are rational, intelligible, obvious, all these words that we've used. So it's not a perfect tool. Like, for example, House of Leaves. House of Leaves is bewildering, but I don't think it's radical in any way. So it's not enough for the aesthetics to be bewildering, but that's a good sign that maybe there's something beneath the surface here that goes beyond those languages.
Yeah, it seems the irony is that science fiction is temporally disjoined, but is not untimely in the way that would be transformative in some cases.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Again, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you met the true transgressive subject, whether through literature or physically, you should be bewildered. You would be confused. They would be unintelligible to you. That's what I'm saying about space societies. Actually, here's an interesting counterexample for all those people that I just gave. Dan Simmons, who wrote Hyperion and a bunch of other stuff. He's a conservative in real life. Like, his politics are conservative. And yet, he does this really interesting thing where a slice of humanity breaks off from the rest of us and goes into deep space. And when they come back, they are unintelligible. They're like butterflies with solar wings. They're using like different sounds to communicate so humans can't understand them. Their societies are like these anarchic, violent sort of war machines. They're like nomad war machines, and they don't compile. So it's interesting that a conservative author wrote something that gets close to what we're talking about here. But even him, I was able to read the book and understand those characters, right? So there's almost like a inherent unsolvable paradox.
That's fascinating. Adam, Mia, go for it.
Yeah, actually, one of the things I wanted to pick up on actually as well from the paper is it kind of makes it hard then for radicality to appear in some of the typical ways in which literature has been used as a kind of a critical edge. Because one of the examples you bring up is kind of the failure of sci-fi to really satirize, mostly because the Jeff Bezos's, the Musk of the world, they just see themselves as living that fantasy. And in a way, they already are. They are just living that. They're surrounded by yes men. And essentially, if the narrative arc of their life ever collapses, then all of the people that they're paying to maintain that narrative arc will eventually like not get paid. It's like the line. No one's going to tell MBS no, because then you'll be seen walking backwards into an embassy and come out in four suitcases. But yeah, if you're surrounded with yes men, instead of fantasy is entirely maintained. But another example you give in terms of the textuality aspect is Warhammer. I mean, who's bewildered by the Black Library?
Not only that, like 40K is like low-hanging fruit because it's so easy to make fun of and to criticize. But that's the point. Like, they fumbled the ball so badly. And I don't remember if we spoke about this last time I was on here, but if you go back to the 80s and you read Warhammer fantasy, some of it is leftist. Also, not like a majority of it, a lot of the stuff there is really interesting and talks about women's liberation, anti-colonial themes, and so on. Fast forward to today, where Nazis love 40K and they love Warhammer Fantasy. And to be clear, I'm not criticizing Games Workshop necessarily, because expecting Games Workshop to do anything about it is ridiculous. That's not what they do. They're a company.
And they don't have to stew us, okay?
Yeah, exactly. But also, like, how could you, like, what satire do you need to write for every single human who will ever read it to understand that it's satire? It's impossible. Satire fails inherently, because there will always be readers who are equal partners in the making of meaning for literary works or any other artistic endeavor that will be like, No, I like the Space Marines. The Space Marines are good, actually. Like, the Empire of Man is good. Well, obviously, a few people who wrote this thing were like, how can we make this as comically evil as possible? And yet, they failed, right? So, it's not their fault. It's the fault of the limitations of satire and of literature to begin with. Another, we mentioned that I relocated to Providence. Not sure if we recorded that, so I'm saying it on air now. Lovecraft. The biggest critic of Lovecraft, this is a good soundbite if you want. The biggest critic of Lovecraft is Wittgenstein. Why? Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one should stay silent. So instead of telling me, imagine a monster you cannot imagine. What do you mean? You just said I can't imagine it. Why would I imagine it? A thing so big, it's too big to conceive of. What do you mean? Like, if it's too big to conceive of, then shut up, right? Like, if you cannot describe it, if it's the indescribable beast from beyond space and time, then why are you describing it to me, right? Which is also, by the way, a criticism of hyperobjects as a philosophical concept. Ooh, an object so big that our categories of mind cannot perceive it. Yeah, but I can actually, because we're talking about it, right? Like, we're talking about climate change. We're talking about oil if we're taking Reza Negastan. Like, it's here. We can conceptualize it. To go back to my positive examples, Jeff Vandermeer, spoilers for Southern Reach, at the end of the books where we discover the alien entity that's doing something, Vandermeer does not describe it. There's like a whole chapter where the characters try to talk about it and they can't. Like, they cannot explain it. So it's inexplicable. But it makes for like bad literature, right? Because you're reading a chapter about nothing, because every time they try to speak about the thing, they can't. But if you're actually trying to describe an alien the face value meaning of the word literary, and it's indescribable, then it's indescribable. So stop describing it, right? But that's, Craig, that's what you mentioned, the paradox. Right, it reaches the point where it annuls itself, it nullifies itself. Like, science fiction wants to go so far, it goes far enough that worlds fail, and then science fiction dies, and then what are we left with?
Yeah, it one thing that's kind of interesting about the function of satire is certain examples, I think Warhammer being the most egregious, is like they couldn't make it more intolerable than they do. Like, like human beings eat other corpses. Like, that's how you exist. Like, you eat the corpses of the war dead. One thing that I kind of, and we made this point when we were talking about Nick Land, everybody knows who that is, unfortunately, where there really isn't anything all that fringe ultimately when you get to his account of technology, that ultimately what he's providing is an aestheticization of the fascist present, and techno-capital singularity is just the total mobilization that's existed since the First World War. It's just, now we're going to say it's going to be on a data sheet somewhere. Like, yeah. That. But of course, this is already the epistemic field within which we manage populations, within which labor power is what? Collected and utilized. So, yeah. Like, you know, you don't need to understand Warhammer to get it. You live it every day. Right? Yeah. Like, you live in a world that has experienced the First and Second World War. Like, Warhammer is just Ernst Jünger's total mobilization brought to the point of like a fascistic wet dream. You know,
yeah. And I always like to, when I read the tagline, in the grim darkness of the far future of the 41st millennium, there is only war. I'm like, in the grim darkness of the 21st century, there is only war. Like, war has never stopped. There has never been peace. We have always been mobilized towards war, at least from the First World War. And you can go back to previous world conflicts and claim that it never stopped since then. I agree with you 100%. And I think to bring in, like, you know, that meme of, if you brought a time traveler or you went back and you gave a peasant, like a 14th century French peasant, like a Sour Patch Kids, their head would blow up because of the flavors or whatever. So I like to think about, like, you bring Freud to like a game of 40K, and he would be like, what the hell is going on? All these people are like the narrator is telling you, you will die, you will suffer, you are meaningless, you are nothing but the flesh and bones on you that serves the empire. And people are like, fuck yeah, that is so cool. I would like to fantasize for 5 hours about being that individual. And like, what? It's so bizarre. And I'm included. Like, I don't play the tabletop, but I play like computer games based on the setting. I'm like, this is bad, but also this is awesome. Like, I'm having a blast imagining myself being that person. Like, how fucked up are we? How many neuroses and death drives do we have that this setting blows us up and like puts it all directly in our faces, and we're like, hell yeah, give me more. I will spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars or pounds or whatever to consume more of this. Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
We do it every day on the highway, right?
yeah, exactly. It gives us a mirror of what we experience day to day, but there's a stop button. Now the simulation ends. The game is done. We close the game. We walk out of the Games Workshop branch and it stops. Whereas the wall that we're actually a part of never stops, and there's no escape, and it's totalizing entirely.
Yeah. About a year ago, after these guys were talking about Warhammer, I downloaded a game on my iPad. I'm like, I got to see what this is all about. It can't be as fascistic as they mentioned. And like even the first cutscene was like, he sacrificed his entire body to be selected by the inner circle of knights to ascend. And then next thing you know, you're just slaughtering people from the robot. Yeah.
So I have to, whenever I talk about 40K in these contexts, I have to give one example, which is a very underread book by David R. Bunch. Wait, let me check that I'm... Yeah, David R. Bunch, Moderan. So this guy has a very interesting story. He published these stories, you know, back in the day, it was more of a magazine sort of society in science fiction, right? You would publish short stories and then collect them into novellas. So he was publishing these all the way back to the 60s, if I'm not mistaken. And it's called the Moderan Sequence. And these were reviled. Like, people hated this guy. They would write letters against him. He got kicked out of all the publishers. No one wanted to run his stuff, because Moderan is about this guy in the future. Earth has been paved over by plastic and everything is mediated. Like, when they want birds, they fire skeet birds out of cannons to simulate the flight of birds. And this guy has been selected to become Fortress Number 10. And through excruciating surgeries, he becomes the nomadic war machine. He becomes this entity. He himself can launch like multiple nuclear missiles, and he has automated armies at his command. And there are more of him, and they control the entire world, these overlords. And all they do all day is try to kill each other, but they can't because they're of equal power. And they're just constantly fighting. And it goes further than that. It's really wild. They become beams of energy, and it's super fascist, super militarist, super misogynist as well. He has like these awful chapters about women, but it's satire. Right? Like, this guy is not endorsing these ideas, he's writing against them, but he actually took it to an extent where people were like, if you read some of the letters that people published against him, like physically sick from reading it. It's messed up. So it was collected finally into one collection like a few years ago by who released it, one sec, like a big publication. It was finally, like, you know, reinstated as a classic of science fiction. Or the New York Review of Books, they published it, like, reinstated as this outlier and a true fringe writer that went so far with his satire that people found it, you know, unpleasant to read. I want to say pleasure because I enjoyed reading it, but I also really didn't enjoy reading it. It's awful reading it, but it's so powerful because it's us, right? This person exists. It's called the average American, right? Constantly at war with everybody else, constantly externalizing their desire. And when I say American, I don't necessarily mean people who live in America, right? I mean denizens of the American capitalist empire, constantly like paving over the world so it's more intelligible and categorizable and so on. It's a really fascinating read. I would say read it in parts. I also didn't read it in one like go. I did like a few months break and I came back to it. But even if you just read the first like two or three stories, it shows you how satire can really go over the edge and accomplish its goals. But it goes back to the bewilderment. Like, if you're physically uncomfortable, then it's a good sign that maybe something more is happening here than let's all imagine a person who sucks and also has big guns and whatever, because that's, it's not far enough. That's a good place to end. I think that's like a good, like,
right on the hour.
Final note.
Well, one thing I have to confess to you, Eden, before we, you know, kind of wind things down, is I was able to pick up Dead Astronauts, Vandermeer's book, at like one of those cheap book sales where, you know, like it's the old Target or the old Walmart that's shelled out, and there's just a bunch of books there. And I think I picked up for like $3 or something, but it's collecting dust. And now I must read it. This has been your second very strong recommendation of it. So that's going to be my one takeaway.
Very good book. I have a hardcover. I'm a big Vandermeer fan. I have like all of his books, and he does really cool limited editions and so on. Dead Astronauts has versions of the same story happening. So in my like hardcover, it has version numbers in the margins, which are just a cool.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check that out.
Well, I have one final question, but just before, because we don't do Patreon plugs in the middle of the shows. However, we do have something to plug, and that is, if you feel like science fiction, particularly cyberpunk, is increasingly translated into your everyday life, everything from struggles of healthcare to how many hypermediatized systems, you might enjoy chapter one of Anti-Oculus, The Philosophy of Escape by Asset Horizon, pre-orderable now from all good bookstores and a fair few bad ones. Chapter one is called The Cyberpunk Present. And if you haven't noticed it by now, don't worry, it will come for you. But, finalizing, one final question here. I wanted to link it back, Eden, actually, to the essay you wrote preceding this on science fiction as a tool. I had a question about the efficacy of science fiction. But more generally, I guess, you could broaden it out to the efficacy of fiction as such. And so do you think that the realm of the efficacy of fiction is constrained mostly just to expanding the political imagination and to maybe trying to combat hegemony, maybe even create new hegemonies in a kind of like, you know, the Clown Moose sense? Or do you think with science fiction in particular, there could be, let's say, to use a term from the CCRU, a hyper-fictional efficacy to it insofar as a lot of the technology we have that ends up feeding into our sort of cyberpunk present ends up being influenced by science fiction. As you see the example, there were no witches until the witch trials, and now we carry fucking tricorders around with us every day.
Yeah, so I think for me, there are many entry points into struggle and into political activism or whatever, but one of the most interesting ones for myself, and I'm very selfish here when I ask for better science fiction because I love science fiction, is the struggle to create new subjects, right? To perceive more things as not as objects, but as subjects, right? Whether that is animals, other people. We have a big problem of objectification of people, poor people, disabled people, so on. And it's very important to me, and I think I name dropped him last time as well. Maybe I should come back in the future and talk about him properly. Martin Buber, right? My ethics come from the ability to perceive the other as a thou, as a you, as a subject, as someone who is distinct from me, but which we share the ability to communicate and we share other traits with. A very good way to think about new things as subjects, as thous, is for fiction. Because fiction can open you up to new ways of thought and of perspective, right? It can cause you to reconsider how your relationship works with a tree or a cat or a poor person or someone with a mental disability or a foreigner or an immigrant or a cop or a headmaster or whoever. A good book, when you read it, you should go, huh, right? I have a new perspective on this thing. That's not enough in and of itself. That's not like the end of activism. But books can be or fiction can be a good way to shake you from your assumptions, your suppositions. Who is a subject? Who is perceived as intelligible? Who can I have a conversation with? A good book can open you up to new opportunities and new conversations and new ways to think about things that you took for granted. And good science fiction can do it for anything, because fiction is usually not weird. right? Like, you're not going to read like a fiction author writing about how a tree can be your best friend. But a science fiction author can do that, right? We haven't mentioned Philip K. Dick. That's a problem. So let me do it now. Philip K. Dick wrote Beyond Lies the Wob, a short story where the wob is a Martian creature that humans eat. But then the wob uses telepathy to get a ship's captain to feel like what it's like to be eaten. And that causes the ship captain to effectively become vegan. Right, so what if animals could tell us what it's like to be eaten? They can't. But a science fiction story can, wield enough one at least, can force you to rethink the animal perspective or the vegetative perspective or the what have you perspective, insert perspective here, right? So when I advocate for weirder fiction, I advocate for it because it can help people start to walk the road towards having conversations with new subjects in new ways, which can lead to better, different, newer politics.